You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Ko tēnei te wire, mā runga 95BFM. You're tuned into the wire on 95BFM. If you have any thoughts to share, please send your texts through to 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Up now, we have the return of the International Desk with Lisa.
There we go. Yes, it's better. It's better when the mic is on. And so I kind of wanted to keep that same format that we had before, that I introduced just once actually before I was gone for 2 weeks. Anyway, it's just a little press review first, and then we kind of have we dive more into one specific topic. So for the press review, I wanted to talk about Cyclone Idai, which devastated parts of the southern part of Africa. Kind of like, to make it more confusing, the northern part of the southern part of Africa. So we're talking about Mozambique, Zimbabwe and Malawi. And it's caused terrible damage in this area. The death toll has now risen above 750 and could continue to rise as floodwaters recede and more fatalities are discovered. More than 100,000 people are now in temporary camps in Mozambique alone. So most publications describe scenes of devastation in the aftermath of the cyclone. For the BBC, a Zimbabwean man talks about the destruction of almost all of the houses and entire families finding refuge on the few remaining rooftops and trees, only rescued thanks to ropes and plastic bottles. The United Nations is asking for $282 million to help the affected areas with water, sanitation and restoration. But flooding in areas of Mozambique, such as the Beira region, which is on the coast, prevents aid groups from finding clean water and accessing health centres. And Al Jazeera reports on aid agencies that alert over sanitation, with cases of cholera, malaria and typhoid having emerged in the last few days. So it's a really big sanitation crisis happening there. But publications in Africa point the finger at climate change as to the cause of such disasters. Burkina Faso online publication called Wakat Sera says that those so-called natural disasters are actually more so man-made. The article points out that the African continent is paying a high price while being only responsible for 4% of the world's global emissions. It blames rich countries for both being responsible for the destruction of the environment and over-industrialization, but also refusing to take responsibility and act upon it. And it finally blames those in power in Africa for accepting international aid without doing anything to protect the populations. And that final point is also shared by a Zimbabwean-based news media outlet called Newsday. It has a similar stance. It blames politicians' lack of climate change literacy. According to the column, confused and clueless politicians and their lack of climate protection strategies should be a cause of concern. The opinion piece laments at the fact that climate change is barely a concern for local politicians, who tend to see it as an imported Western concept, and it urges them to do something substantial about disaster management strategies rather than simply declaring a state of disaster afterwards.
Right. So, geez, it's a big one.
It is a big one, and it's quite bad actually, but it was interesting to look at African publications as well. I think the West kind of tends to just focus on more so the consequences of such disasters rather than trying to, I don't know, reflect on how it has happened. I've also read about how deforestation in Mozambique and Zimbabwe had made it kind of harder as well.
Yeah, it was interesting because 2 weeks ago we looked at Burkina Faso, and there's always, well, among some people in media, that they dismiss a lot of African sources because they are state-sponsored sources in many cases. However, obviously, with these ones, you obviously see a disconnect between what the politicians are wanting to say and what the media are saying, which kind of dispels this kind of myth that all African newspapers are, which has been a line pulled by many, much to, well, at least my dismay, and I assume yours. So, from there, where are we off to Syria next?
Yes, we are actually, because some of our listeners might have read articles about it, but the Islamic State's last enclave in Syria is reportedly defeated, has been defeated, thanks to the United States-backed Kurdish forces. They're called the Syrian Democratic Forces, and they've declared victory against the Islamic State on Saturday, liberating the last jihadist stronghold in the eastern Syrian village of Barghouz. So that's quite the event. So almost 5 years after it was declared by leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the caliphate is physically no more. And whilst they celebrate, in the words of British Prime Minister Theresa May, a historic milestone, Western coalition leaders also remain very cautious. They all agree that the fight is actually not over. In an article in American magazine, The Atlantic, it's pointed out that while territorial ISIS may have disappeared, its money, and there's a lot of it, hasn't disappeared. The article, which is really great, by the way, explains how the United States tried to squeeze the group financially through actions such as sanctioning of Islamic State-linked businesses, denying them access to international financial system, and working in close cooperation with governments across the globe. But this battle is potentially way lengthier and less rewarding than the field military one. What this article also says is that the loss of territory has made it harder for the Islamic State to rely on its main source of revenue, which were petrol, and that you find in Iraq and Syria, and also taxing citizens that were controlled by ISIS. But also, according to this article, ISIS could raise roughly, back in the days, ISIS could raise roughly up to $1 million per day through those systems. But the loss of territory also means that the group now actually only has to focus on its terrorist activity. And the money that was accumulated over time has all but disappeared. A lot of it has actually been laundered through legitimate businesses in Iraq and Syria. And ISIS had massive records on the population it controlled. We're talking like 7 or 8 million people. So there's legitimate fear that those records, if they still exist, could be used for extortion, and so a new source of finance. And so the article conclusion is actually very pessimistic. It says, literally, don't expect the Islamic State to go out of business anytime soon. Other things linked to that, unless you want to add something?
Yeah, carry on.
Okay, so linked to ISIS. Another legitimate worry is put into words by German newspaper Deutsche Welle. It says, what will happen to the thousands of ISIS members who surrendered in the final phase of the battle in Syria? We're talking 65,000 people that are currently detained in camps run by the Syrian Kurds, and amongst them, thousands of foreigners. And the Kurds say that they are overwhelmed and they don't have anywhere, regardless of proper justice system. And we're also mentioning trials in Iraq, but it could prove quite difficult. Also, Iraq has the death penalty, and that might cause issues in terms of international law. And trials by the Assad regime in Syria is not considered an option by a lot of countries that were involved. And so Iraq is not part of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, but there could be a case for the establishment of a special international tribunal. So all of that is kind of up in the air at the moment. And in the meantime, obviously, there's still thousands of people in camps. And so I mentioned foreign fighters. What of the thousands of them that are in those camps? Well, in an article from actually last week, the Irish Times wonders how Europe is dealing with the return of its ISIS jihadists. And very small number of Irish citizens that have joined ISIS, and the absence of terror attack on Irish soil could explain that, why Ireland's position is quite a bit different from the rest of Europe. Because Ireland has said that its citizens will have the right to return home, and so will their children, but that's quite, different from what other European countries have done. But that also could be due to the fact that Ireland has not introduced any legislation specifically targeting people that joined the Islamic State. So the United States is demanding countries take back their ISIS-linked citizens, but countries like France, Belgium, Germany, or Great Britain actually struggle with the balancing of public opinion on one side, public safety, and also the legal frame. France seems to be focusing on children. They seem to be seen as harmless victims of choices made by adults. But French President Emmanuel Macron said that the plight of these children would be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. And in Germany, Germany's trying to deal with women. They have... Germany's dealing with women has been criticised for being too relaxed, because German judges have actually ruled that women who simply took care of households or their children in ISIS territories did not commit a criminal offence, which makes it harder for them to be judged for something that they haven't committed, obviously. But the United Nations and terrorism experts are urging all of these European countries to actually, in all of those that had foreign fighters in Islamic State-controlled territories, to continue highly monitoring these people upon their return. The caliphate might be gone, but the Islamic State, its influence and the consequences of its action have not disappeared.
I guess that almost adds a certain level of spontaneity to the ability of ISIL going forward, now that they're not grounded to a base like they were in Mosul or Raqqa or Baghouz, I believe. So where are we off to now? Thailand,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, we're off to Thailand. I'll try to keep it short and simple, which is always sort of complicated. We're talking about general elections, which happened over the weekend. And so Thai people were voting to fill this 500 seats of the House of Representatives that was dissolved by the military coup in 2014. And so it's the first general election to be held since the coup, and it's the first under the 2017 constitution, which was drafted by the military junta. And so, do you say junta or do you say junta? I don't know.
I've heard both.
Okay.
So I have no clue. Progress with what you think's best,
All right. I'll stick with the first one then. But before we look at this electoral system, I just wanted to do what I hope to be a little historical recap. So the Kingdom of Thailand, which still has a king at its helm, has become a constitutional monarchy in 1932 after a revolution that saw the country's first written constitution following the revolution. Anyway, ever since, it's actually experienced a lot of instability. It actually experienced 12 military takeover in the last 90 years, which is quite a lot.
Just a few?
Yeah, once every, I think, 7 years or something. And so that, to understand what's happening now, though, related to that specific election, I have to kind of go back to the 2000s. So in 2001, telecommunications multimillionaire Thaksin Shinawatra is elected, and he's re-elected in 2005 by a landslide. He's probably one of Thailand's most popular leader, but he always was quite divisive. He introduced a lot of economic reforms that greatly benefited the rural areas. So a lot of people think his politics were quite populist. But he also was accused of corruption. He had corruption charges against him and bribery charges against them, and he became really unpopular amongst the more urban middle class, which led to massive public protests and calls for his resignation. So in 2006, he made a failed attempt at re-electing the parliament, and that led to a constitutional crisis, which ended with the military coup in September 2006. And in the past 10 years, sort of, have been quite unstable in Thailand. And the society, the Thai society, has actually been very divided. So between 2008 and 2010, there was a big political crisis with, our listeners might have heard, the opposing red shirts opposing the yellow shirts. So the red shirts were in sort of supporting Thaksin, and the yellow shirts were opposing him, to keep it very simple. Anyway, after bribery accusations against him, and I think against his wife as well, Thaksin Shinawatra fled to Great Britain in 2008. Now, if you fast forward to 2013, his sister, Yingluck Shinawatra, she's at the head of the Pheu Thai Party and the Prime Minister, and this Pheu Thai party, which is a new party then, is actually kind of hits its policies are quite go alongside those of Thaksin and what was before. So she tries to put forward amnesty proposals and amendments, and that would cover the whole 2004 to 2013 period, which would include her brother's corruption charges. That leads to quite massive protests again, seizure of government buildings, dissolution of the government, more protests, state of emergency, more protests, more failed Tamil elections, and finally in May 2014, another military coup. You've got martial law declared nationwide, and Army Chief General Prayut Chan-o-cha is appointed Prime Minister, and he is still in power today, and he is trying to get re-elected democratically. And so those elections have been promised time and time again. They've always been delayed, and there was a longing from the population for democratic and fair elections. And so these elections finally occurred over the weekend, but that was after a new constitution was drafted in 2017. And that's important because this constitution has actually quite dramatically changed the way representatives are being elected in Thailand. And I don't really have much time to talk about it, but I'll go fast. Basically, the new system, it's like a mixed system. There's 500 seats that representatives get elected for. And what happens is that people vote for constituency and nationwide party lists seats. To keep it simple, basically, for a party to be for a prime minister to be appointed, the party that it comes from needs to have basically 370 seats total, mixed Senate and House of Representatives. And the problem is that the Senate is appointed directly by the military junta, which means that we're assuming that all of its members will be loyal to the current prime minister, which is part of the military junta. So that means the party that the current prime minister is from only actually needs a remaining, I think, 126 votes in the House of Representatives, whilst its opposing party actually needs all 376 because they don't have the support from the Senate. So a lot of people have actually talked about how this new constitution and the system that it brought in Thailand have actually kind of skewed the whole electoral system. Human Rights Watch is actually denouncing the overpowerful Senate and points out to serious problems within the electoral process, amongst which repressive laws regarding freedom of speech, association and assembly, but also media censorship, lack of independence and impartiality of the National Election Commission, which dissolved actually a major party, opposition party, during the campaign. And talking of campaign, the political campaigning for this election was only allowed since the beginning of February, so we're talking like a month and a half. And it was marked by multiple legal cases against politicians who criticised the army. So that was problematic. The election itself seems problematic. Reports of irregularities around the country cast a doubt over the fairness of the vote. A large amount of ballots were invalidated. Some ballots that were marked improperly would actually have been counted as votes for the pro-junta party. There's reports of, in some areas, voters turnout reported to be 200%. In other areas, you've got number of ballots exceeding number of voters. So all of these things are actually fairly strange, I suppose. And the results have still not come out. Part of the results have come out, but the rest is kind of held by the Electoral Commission.
Right.
Which makes it kind of problematic because this commission is actually appointed by the military.
Well, yeah. It sounds like a bit of a confusing state. Hopefully something comes of it eventually.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.